name is Eric Bowe, and welcome to the Primal Shopper Podcast. This podcast is for marketers, entrepreneurs, and academics interested in understanding why we shop the way we do. My goal is to focus on primal motivations driving our behaviors and how to apply the learnings to improve your marketing. Don't worry about taking notes. I'll include any links in the show notes. Also, there is plenty of bonus content on primalshopper.com. Finally, if you want a more in-depth perspective, I'm publishing a book probably in the next 30 to 60 days, which will provide a lot more detail on the topics I cover in this podcast. It's the new year. First question I have for you is, do you have a New Year's resolution? Do you have more than one? Think back to last year. Did your resolution stick, or how long did you last? 3 weeks, a month, 6 months? If it lasted 6 months, that's pretty good. From a New Year's resolution perspective, there was a survey done by YouGov, and roughly about 68% of people planned on having at least one New Year's resolutions. Resolutions are an attempt for us to change who we are for the better. Sometimes we are successful, many times we are not. But here's the cool thing. By understanding our attempt to keep a New Year's resolution, our attempt to change our stripes, we can also understand what it takes to change shopping behaviors. And changing shop behaviors is very interesting, and I'm going to get into that a lot in later in this podcast, because can you really change a shopper's stripes through your marketing? Can you make them behave counter to their primal motivations? That's the topic for this episode. I'm going to cover three things in this episode. First of all, from a personal level, what is the true cost to change your stripes? What would it take to make that resolution stick? Secondly, forget resolutions. We're going to talk about developing a habit. And finally, can you change a shopper's stripes with your marketing? And we'll get into several levels of how you can do that. Let's first talk about resolutions and the cost to make them stick. Cost it can be measured in different ways. There's cost in time, effort, and money. From a money perspective, here's some numbers for you. $696, $1,750, and $1,600. These numbers are estimated annual costs by CheatSheet.com for some of the more popular New Year's resolutions. For example, $696 is the annual cost of a gym membership. Now, you could probably do this for a lot cheaper, but if you join a gym, this is the average cost somebody would pay to be at a gym for the entire year. $1,750 is the average cost for a weight loss program. Now, this varies. You can go on $168 on the low end, like a Weight Watcher or something like that, to a weight loss program that provides you a lot of food and actually ships it to you and everything else. So there is a range here, but again, there's that external cost that you have to pay to actually stick to your resolution. The last one's interesting. It's $1,600. It's an interest savings by actually controlling your credit card debt. A lot of people's New Year's resolutions is to be smarter with their money. And to be smarter than money is actually reducing your debt and budgeting. Two difficult things we tend to have a hard time to do as Americans. And I want to read this. This is right from the CheatSheet.com site. I love the way they phrase this. Credit card debt is a serious issue for Americans. The average household now carries $5,700 in revolving credit card debt, according to Value Penguin. The average for balance-carrying households is $9,333. Think about that, $9,333 on average. This is why you're looking at a $1,600 savings if you could pay that off and keep it off. Now, the first two costs are out of pocket, and the last one really is more of a savings. But all three of these, if you're going to do them, require effort. They require effort to change who we are. They require effort to alter our preferred way to act. And effort to train ourselves to possibly go against an innate desire which fuels that behavior on why we're actually doing a resolution in the first place. The key to these efforts is we need to focus, we need to think, because these actions are ingrained in our subconscious. So this gets me to the second topic. This isn't about a resolution. This is about creating a new habit. As I do this podcast, we're coming up to a pseudo holiday on January 17th. It's called National Quit Your Resolution Day. Obviously, this day is arbitrary. Some people may have quit their resolution already, and some people may keep the resolution for many months to come. But the date's interesting because it's within 3 weeks of when people normally make their resolution. And a general rule of thumb is that it takes about 3 weeks to stay on something to actually make it a habit. It doesn't guarantee you'll keep the habit forever, but usually it takes about 3 weeks for it to get ingrained in you to become a part of who you are. And this is about creating change internally. So let's talk about creating a habit. A book out there by Charles Duhigg is called The Power of Habit Book. I would highly recommend this. I read it a while ago. In it, he has a very concise, what I'll call a habit cycle. There's three steps to it. There's the cue, which initiates the habit, your actual habitual routine, and then the reward you receive at the end. The cue, in his words, can be a location, a time of day, an emotion. It could be other people or a consistent pattern of behavior. The routine is the habit itself, and then the reward is normally some form of an emotional satisfaction that fuels the habit and creates the cycle. Charles Duhigg explains to change these cycles, you first really need to understand why you behave a certain way, why the cue occurs, and then most importantly, what was the reward at the end that actually kept you doing the same habit? Let's apply this habit cycle to the last resolution I talked about, which is spending less money or being smarter with your money in 2019. What Charles Duhigg recommends is really doing a log and for a while just tracking what happens when you're spending money in this case and try to get to the why of what's going on here. For example, what are the cues that are triggering spending? Is it a need versus a want? How much of your spending is impulsive? Is it related to an emotional goal? A goal, for example, like feeling better. Is it related to a passion you may have? For example, you may be a tech enthusiast and whenever you see a new tech device, you go out and buy it. Problem with that often is that you're paying full price because rarely is the new product a deal. Your passion could be golf, it could be fashion, it could be a lot of things. Do you have more of an open wallet syndrome when you're actually buying products within your passion? On another note, are there stores or online sites that trigger this behavior? For some people, it could be Amazon. I mean, just if you get a chance, go to Twitter, type in hashtag Amazon addiction, and you'll see people out there that feel the ease of buying on Amazon has become an addiction to spending money. It's been well noted in research with QVC and HSN. A lot of those trigger these behaviors. It also could be within a store that once you get in this retail environment, you actually spend more than you anticipated. An example of this is Target. Target is notorious for the following phrase: when I go into Target, it's hard to spend less than $100. Evidence of this angst can be found on Twitter. Just go to Twitter and search for Target and $100. And what you'll see is a lot of tweets about people who, I don't want to say they're really angry, but they're often surprised that no matter how they try, they can't walk out of Target without spending that $100. And every so often, you will find a tweet of somebody who was they successfully left Target without spending $100, and they're very joyful that they were able to control their spending within Target. Moving beyond the cue, when you're spending more than you should, is there a consistent routine? And this may be back to the store, for example, where you find that you are cost conscious until you get within a certain environment, and then you find out you loosen up your control and you end up spending more than you anticipated. Ultimately, you want to also do an introspective look at what was the emotional reward upon purchase. What type of emotional benefit did this spending provide? Then you can start taking a step back and looking at the overall cue, the routine, and the reward and assess how can I replace this behavior and still get the same reward out of it? Which in the end, this is what you're trying to do. And Charles Duhigg gets into this a lot in his book. By understanding how you can now address the cues and try different routines, you hopefully can get to the same emotional benefit. This is a very brief summation of the book. I would highly recommend reading the book. You can find it on Amazon, and I included a link in the show notes for those interested in picking up a copy. The last part of this podcast, I want to really focus on, can you change shopper stripes? Can you develop habits through your marketing? What I want to do is focus on two shopper DNA strands for this, brand and wallet. Brand, if you remember, is brand citizen and free agent. Wallet is deal seeker versus price blind. The ideal typology for a marketer is really this brand citizen, price blind. They love your brand, and price is not going to influence them away from you to another brand. Obviously, the opposite of this is free agent, deal seeker. Free agent, people, brand doesn't matter. Usually something is more important in their purchase process, which is driving their decisions. In this case, it is the deal seeker mentality. So by focusing on those two, you can start looking at what is the cue, what is the routine, and ultimately what is the reward. So how do you move these shoppers? You first need to understand the reward, the desire. The true deal seeker is motivated by an adrenaline rush. This is a physiological change that they have to have that sort of drives them within the retail environment to get the deal and to exert the effort to get the best deal. However, there's something interesting about this. It doesn't mean they're going to do it all the time. Sometimes this deal seeking actually goes from an active search to a habit. And let me explain this a little. There was a study I did a while back about the price sensitivity of buying gas. The way we looked at it was how many people truly are choosing a station based on the best price, and just as importantly, how many people actually got the best price. And I know this sounds a little strange, but if you ask people, why did you choose a station? They'll say, hey, it was the lowest price of gas. But was it really the lowest price, especially if they've gone there every time? So we're looking at people specifically who go to the station, same station every time. So think about it this way. If I ask you the question, how many times did you go to Speedway? And you said, of the last five times I fueled, I went to Speedway all five times. That's a sign of a habit. That's actually how we measure habit, is behavioral. But did that mean these people really got the lowest price? So the way this worked is we asked them, first of all, where did they fuel? What were the primary reasons? In this case, one of the primary reasons was it was the lowest price. Then we asked them for the crossroads of the station where they fueled at. We were able to then go into Gas Buddy and then triangulate gas prices to figure out, did they truly get the lowest price relative to nearby stations? We found something very interesting with this. And it really, in a nutshell, was a third, a third, a third. One third got the lowest price. If you looked at nearby stations, they paid the lowest price. About a third paid the same price as a nearby station, but it still was the lowest price. The last third's the most interesting. They paid more than a nearby station. How could this happen? Well, the interesting thing about our shopping is that over time we develop habits. Through experience, we try stuff, we buy stuff, we find great deals, and we don't go back through the entire process necessarily from scratch, but we actually move on. And a lot of it becomes subconscious, a lot of it becomes habitual. So these people who paid more at one time probably did figure out, relative to where they live, this was the lowest price station. However, they stopped looking after a while and they just kept going to that station, and their belief system as a deal seeker was they were still getting the lowest price, even though if they looked a little further, they weren't. Some brands out there get this and they realize that they need to create a habit. One who is very good at this, in my opinion, is Kohl's. They do a really good job with two things, coupons and Kohl's Cash. The coupons come in the mail and it's a peel-off sticker. Many of you know this already, and you'll get either 10, 20, or 30% off, or maybe even 15. If you get the 30% off, it's like there's an exhilaration that I can go into Kohl's and I'll get 30% off of everything. So you go in, you get that, and when you're checking out, they do the second thing. It's the boomerang option where I want to get you to come back, and that's the Kohl's Cash. The Kohl's Cash has an interesting psychology on different people. Like for my wife in particular, when we have Kohl's Cash, she sees it like money we have to spend. Now, Kohl's is banking that when my wife goes back in there, and let's say we have $10 worth of Kohl's Cash, she's going to spend more than that. Through the course of doing the book, I can tell you flat out, the true deal seeker is going, okay, I have $10. I'm not going to waste it, but I'm going to try to get to $10 exactly because I don't want to give Kohl's the satisfaction of getting me to come back and spending more than I planned on it. So these people spend a lot of time in the store looking for something they truly need and just spending the Kohl's Cash that they have on hand. One downside of Kohl's approach is when you take out the coupon and take out the Kohl's Cash, are you going to still get people coming to Kohl's? Well, first of all, I doubt if they would do this, and I would not recommend them do this by any means, but I think the behaviors would definitely change for a lot of people because the cue is that coupon, which gets them there, and the second cue is the Kohl's Cash, which kicks into a routine. Another marketer who is really moving this person from free agent to brand citizen is Kroger. And let me give you an example of how Kroger's doing this from a personal perspective. One thing they do rather nicely is on a regular basis, and I don't know the exact timing, but on a regular basis, they send out personalized coupons, and you can tell what they're doing based on my Kroger rewards card. They are looking at my purchase behaviors, and they're giving me specific items that I buy on a regular basis, again, as a cue, as a stimulus to get me to buy more. There might be some fringe products in there, but I've noticed that a lot of these coupons are the hardcore things I buy on a regular basis. In addition to these personalized coupons, Kroger does a nice job on their website of integrating digital coupons into when you make a list for them. Whether you're doing the pickup or you're doing a list to go into the store and buy stuff, it'll flag you when there's a digital coupon that you can actually load right on your card. It's seamless, it's easy, and you feel you're saving more money. It's feeding that adrenaline rush, which is really nice. Now let's segue into the store. Kroger does a very nice job of just peppering you with pricing psychology in the store. They do everything from you buy five items of a specific type, you get $5 off. They'll do BOGO. They'll buy three and you'll save a lot of money. And I've talked about this on other podcasts. The cool part about this from a deal seeker's mentality is that it may create an impulsive behavior in you when you're in the store and you may go off the list that you brought in the store. For example, I went to Kroger last week, I think it was, and they had buy five items, save $5. And what I ended up doing is loading up on certain things, like loading up on certain shelf-stable type of items, like laundry detergent, toilet paper, things that you can buy that you know you're going to need eventually. My total grocery bill ended up being about $200, and after deducting the digital coupons, deducting the five for fives, I ended up with $60 in savings. Even though I know what's going on here, I felt a rush. I felt a little bit of pride of look what I did. Beyond the store, Kroger has one more layer they use, as do other grocers, and that is fuel perks. So what they'll do, and many of you are familiar with this program, what they'll do in a given month is they will keep totaling up your dollar amount and you can get that much off up to $1 at the fuel pump. Now, the interesting thing about this, of all of the different deals you can get in groceries, fuel perks is shared more than anything else on Twitter. You won't see people sharing a coupon or a receipt, but you will see shots of the pump in the actual price per gallon they pay. And this sort of sums up Kroger's deal journey of how they're actually moving people from free agent to brand citizen. What they're doing is before the store, they're hitting you with personalized coupons and digital coupons as you build your list. In the store, they have a lot of different promotions they're using on an ongoing basis to mix it up, to get you thinking, to get you to buy more. And then over multiple trips, they offer up fuel perks so that you feel you're also saving at the pump. I would like to shift gears a little bit here and give you a hotel example of the same thing. I did a hotel study a while back, and here's some interesting numbers, 40%, 22%. These two numbers are the online travel agency, the OTA booking rates for free agent deal seeker and brand citizen deal seeker. For those who aren't familiar with what the OTAs are or online travel agents, this is Expedia, Kayak, Hotels.com. And as you're well aware, these marketers are all over the commercials promising the best deal, the best rate on a hotel room, on a flight, and things like that. So it's important from a hotel to move people beyond free agent to brand citizen whenever possible. So the 40, and think about this. If you're a free agent deal seeker, you are booking your hotel at a 40% rate through OTAs. It dropped automatically down to 22%. And I'll talk about later how you moved to Priceline and how that affected. But that's a big jump in revenue because with every transaction, with every reservation, the hotel has to pay out to these OTAs a certain sum of money. So what if I'm a hotel and I want to move you from free agent to deal seeker? How do you do that? A simple way to do this is remember the guest and use direct marketing to fuel the deal to get them to return. You're not taking the deal away. What you're doing is understanding that this person came in from an OTA. And if you want to get them back, what you need to do is feed them a deal. A second method would be to get them to join your loyalty program. In the study, what we found out is loyalty was like OTA kryptonite. This moves the shopper from a transaction-based mindset to a brand relationship and also looking at a bigger reward down the road. So of the two options, getting them into a loyalty program, however you do it, is highly recommended because you're still getting somebody with a deal-seeking mentality, but what you're doing is moving them from free agent to brand citizen. Okay, now let's talk about moving a shopper from Brand Citizen Deal Seeker to Brand Citizen Priceline. This is a little harder to do because what you're saying to this person, to this deal seeker, to this shopper, is ignore the adrenaline rush. That adrenaline rush guides them in many, many purchases. And by the way, just I'm going to say it right off the bat. There are some deal seekers who are zealous in their approach to save money, and it's doubtful you'll be able to move these people. However, there is a method to do this. And let's talk about hotels still. And again, two numbers again. The 22% for Brand Citizen Deal Seeker, when you go to Brand Citizen Priceline, that jumps down to 7%. Only 7% of these people are booking through an OTA. So how do you move these people? Well, what you need to do is trump the deal-seeking desire with another desire. As a hotel marketer, you have two choices. You can market your hotel as a place to stay, or you can market your hotel as a vacation solution. Recently, I saw some ads from Hilton, and I was actually surprised by them. It really talked more about price and selection of a hotel. Nothing really special. I mean, the Hilton brand obviously is a premium brand. It's a nice hotel, but they really didn't play off the premium nature of how you would do that. They just talked more about here's what you get to select. And oh, by the way, they have a price guarantee. If you can find a better rate, Hilton will match that rate plus 25%. Personally, I think, going off topic a little bit here, I think these price guarantees are a lot of BS. Now, I like the way Hilton did it because they're going to, if you find a better deal, they're going to give you 25% reduction in cost. However, what is the comparative? Is it another Hilton? Is it a Hyatt? Is it a Days Inn? This is where the BS comes in a little bit, because what is the price guarantee? And they don't really cover this in a commercial. They just sort of slap it on the end. And this is where I don't like when marketers do that, because the price guarantee puts the onus on the shopper. If you truly have the lowest rates, then say you have the lowest rates and prove it by comparing yourselves to others. Don't make shoppers work. Well, anyway, let's get back on topic here. So like I was saying, if you're a hotel marketer, you can market yourself as a place to stay or as a vacation solution. If you're going to do a vacation solution, you really need to understand the core desire of that planner. And I've done a lot of work in travel, and I've looked at a lot of different things. And I want to talk about two of these. One is a romantic solution. The other is a family solution. The romantic solution is interesting because what we looked at a lot is this is a male person trying to plan a romantic weekend for them and their significant other. What they really want to do, their core desire, their emotion, is to be that romantic hero. And being of the male persuasion, I can tell you flat out, we usually need some help. So what we often did from a hotel perspective, from a resort perspective, we did a check-in to check-out itinerary of romantic experiences you would actually have at that location. Key to this, though, is you need to go beyond the cliched items you can get anywhere. So having, say, you get a candlelight dinner, okay, maybe roses in the room, nice. These things you should still do, but they're sort of like, that's where the bar is on this stuff. You need to preferably have something that's a little more iconic and unique to your destination. And it doesn't need to be at the hotel necessarily. It could be at a nearby location or a partnership you have with somebody to really add that iconic thing that differentiates your romantic package from other options. Another one is a family solution. And the interesting target here is what we use was called the vacation mediator. A vacation mediator is often the mother, and what she's trying to do is make everybody happy. This becomes a challenge, especially if you have multiple kids. I personally have two kids, and I'll tell you, whenever we plan a vacation, they want very different things. So the vacation mediator is looking for that experience, which, number one, all family members are energized to go. But number two, the vacation mediator's core desire is really family time. Now, family time, probably a little, it's expected. I mean, you get it. But it's a little bit more than that, because you can have family time, and it could just be miserable. So one of the things we did for this specific resort is we pulled the Instagram feed and we really looked at the family photos, the selfies they were taking and everything else. And something occurred that was really interesting is that in all the pictures, typically everybody's smiling, but the parent, the mother, the vacation mediator, her smile was just that much bigger. You could tell by looking at these photos that not only were her kids having a great time, but the family time together was energizing. They were having a lot of fun. And this is the key part to it. It isn't just the family time. is finding those experiences, like I talked with a romantic escape artist, that will energize that smile, not only for the children, but also for the parent, because they know everybody's having a great time. Whenever I consult hotels or resorts, I encourage them to figure out the vacation solution, to find the different targets that typically come there and the ones they're missing out on, and build packages around this. Because if they don't, and it's all about a head and a bed, they will become commoditized. And shoppers will be making decisions not based on the desire of their vacation, but they'll be making decisions based on deal seeking, based on price. And most of these premium hotels or resorts, they can't compete on price, nor should they, by the way, which is all the more reason to figure out how to leverage your marketing to move the shopper from a deal seeker to price blind. So this year, your New Year's resolution should be about how to change your shopper's habits, how to use your marketing to shift behaviors that are more fortuitous to your brand. If you have any questions or want assistance, feel free to reach out to me. My contact information is on primalshopper.com. And that's about it for this episode. So first off, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, I encourage you to subscribe to future episodes on primalshopper.com. Also, on primalshopper.com, you will find a lot more information about primal DNA and shopper typologies, including the ability to take a test. Well, that's it for now. Happy New Year, everyone. And until next time, this is Eric Bowe on the Primal Shopper Podcast.